While you're in the mood to clap, I'd like to announce that this morning we will do a special Memorial Day presentation on the Battle of the Yadrang Valley in Vietnam in November of 1965. There are a number of people in our congregation of whom I'm aware served in Vietnam during that conflict. I will recite the names of those I know, and then others I will ask to stand if there are others. First of all, I'd like to recognize Rick Boyles. He's sitting to my right and refuses to stand up. Les Gatto, I think he was a Marine. Harry Tague, are you in the room? And Jim Hunt. I didn't have a chance to interview the entire congregation. Is there another? All right, then I would like all those who have served in the United States Armed Forces to please stand. Thank you, gentlemen. We salute you as well as all who have served, especially those who have given their lives in the line of duty. This is the celebration of Memorial Day, and we continue to send our young men into battle. As we prepare for our study today, we're going to note probably the most decisive battle of the Vietnam War. It was the one that changed the way the battle was comprehended and ultimately fought. And I will present it to you after we pause for a few moments of silent prayer. I would like for you to consider today's lesson as a Bible study because it will demonstrate that Jesus Christ controls history, but at the same time, many people have to make the ultimate sacrifice in the defense of freedom. Shall we pray? Father, we do thank you for this opportunity to gather here on this special day in which our country celebrates Memorial Day. We thank you for all who have served, given the ultimate sacrifice, those who have been injured, those who survived without a scratch, but yes, gave their all in the service of this country. Our nation is in dire straits presently, and therefore our freedom can be short-lived if we as believers in Jesus Christ do not provide that invisible power that can preserve us in history. It is our prayer that as we reflect back today on events that happened 40 years ago, that you will sustain us and show us how it is through military victory that freedom is acquired and maintained. And we lift our prayer in the name of the Lord of the armies, our Lord Jesus Christ. Amen. Back in January 1965, my two closest friends were among those who served as groomsmen when I was privileged to marry Jo Henry. I was a recent graduate of the University of Alabama School of Broadcast Communications and had worked for an NBC affiliate in Montgomery for about 6 months. Bo Gaylord, my next-door neighbor, worked in the movie business. And Jim Lawrence, a recent graduate of the Citadel, was a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army stationed at Fort Benning, Georgia. The three of us grew up together in our small southern hometown of Troy, Alabama. We served each other as groomsmen in each of our weddings. We were avid baseball fans who abandoned our wives on occasion and went to our own fantasy camps to Florida spring training. At various times, we either played, coached, or umpired baseball. Yet in the spring of 1965, although we were men legally, we were not men really. We three were still yet to face the raw realities of life, although convinced at the time that we were on top of the world. Bo and I continued in private life, but Jim owed the United States government a 4-year hitch in the Army. Circumstances would soon occur that would project him into adulthood far faster than his civilian buddies. In July 1965, the Pentagon announced that the 11th Air Assault Division would be renamed 1st Cavalry Division Air Mobile, and it would take over the colors of that historic division that had distinguished itself in combat in the Korean War and in the Pacific Theater during World War II. By this time, Jim was first lieutenant and executive officer of Delta Company, 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry, 1st Cavalry Division. The 7th Cavalry, by the way, was made famous, or rather infamous, back in the horse cavalry days by General George Custer, whose entire command of over 250 men were massacred on the morning of June 25th of 1876 on the banks of Montana's Little Bighorn River by the Dakota Sioux's Teton Division led by Sitting Bull. Not a single U.S. soldier of the 7th Cavalry survived. Now the 7th Cavalry was back in business, and on July the 28th of 1965, President Lyndon Johnson mobilized Jim's division. It was the first buildup of many that were to follow in Johnson's micromanagement of this war. Jim and other Rangers of the 1st Cavalry Division cast off aboard the USNS Maurice Rose from Charleston, South Carolina, the home of the Citadel, on Monday, August 16th of 1965. On that very same date, the last elements of the 66th Regiment of the People's Army of North Vietnam left their base in Thuan Hoa, North Vietnam, and headed south on foot. The 1st Cavalry Division took 1 month to arrive at Quy Nhon, South Vietnam. It would take the 66th Regiment 2 months to cover 500 miles on foot along the Ho Chi Minh Trail to a spot in the Central Highlands and a base camp established at the Chupong Massif, which is a mountain, but it's a jagged mountain. It's the prominent promontory of a mountain range, and they called it a massif, but it was a mountain. Below this sprawl, the very famous Yadrang Valley. It would become the site of the first major engagement between the armies of North Vietnam and the United States. Two battles would occur in this valley from November the 14th through November 18th of 1965. The first began on Sunday morning, November 14th. The 1st Battalion of the 7th Cavalry under Lieutenant Colonel Harold G. Moore ignited the conflict by surprising the North Vietnamese enclave previously undiscovered and located very deep in the Central Highlands. As you look at the map on the board, this is the best I could do from the Internet, but if you're able to read the small print, the Chupong Massif is located here, and down below it in the Yadrang Valley, you have landing zone X-ray. The Yadrang Valley covers this whole area running along the base here. The Yadrang River, of course, meanders through the area. We're going to see on another map a little later when we move to landing zone Albany, it's just approximately north of a ways from landing zone X-ray. Now, the drama that unfolded in this initial battle is portrayed in the 2002 motion picture, We Were Soldiers. It is the screen version of the account of the battles published in 1992 by Colonel Moore and UPI journalist, also photojournalist, Joseph L. Galloway. Their book is the major source of the information then for this study. Moore writes on page 16 of the prologue the following: "This story is our testament of our tribute to 234 young Americans who died beside us during 4 days in landing zone X-ray and landing zone Albany in the Valley of Death, 1965. This is more Americans than were killed in any regiment, north or south, at the Battle of Gettysburg, and far more than were killed in combat in the entire Persian Gulf War. 70 more of our comrades died in the Yadrang in desperate skirmishes before and after the big battles at X-ray and at Albany. All the names, 305 of them, are engraved on panel 3 east of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C., as well as on our hearts. Now, under orders from Assistant Division Commander Brigadier General Richard T. Knowles, and delivered to Lieutenant Colonel Moore by 3rd Brigade Commander Colonel Thomas W. Brown, the 1st Battalion of the 7th Cavalry was ordered to take the battle to the enemy and to kill them. According to Colonel Moore, here's what transpired. I felt strongly that the enemy had been using the Yadrang Valley as a jumping-off point for the attacks on Play Me and likely had returned there to regroup and to treat their wounded. The Yadrang had plenty of water for drinking and for cooking rice. Best of all, it was the location on the border of Cambodia. The Vietnamese communists came and went across that border at will. We were prohibited from crossing it. Does that sound familiar? The dominant terrain feature is the Chu Phong Massif, rising to just over 2,400 feet, a jumble of mountains, valleys, ravines, and ridges that runs westward for more than 15 miles, the last five of them inside Cambodia. North to south, the massif measures between 10 and 13 miles. The limestone heights of the Chu Phong are full of streams, springs, and caves. Along the massif's north side runs the Yadrang, and Ya means river. And by the time it reaches the Chu Phong area, it is swift and deep, and during the monsoon, it is a raging torrent. The newly arrived 1st Cavalry Division, Air Mobile, had already interfered with and changed North Vietnamese Brigadier General Chu Huy Mon's audacious plans to seize the Central Highlands. Strategically, he who holds the Central Highlands controls Vietnam. Chu Huy Mon's goal was to draw the Americans into battle, to learn how they fought, and teach his men how to kill them. One understrength battalion had had the temerity to land by helicopter right in the heart of General Mon's base camp, a historic sanctuary so far from any road that neither the French nor the South Vietnamese Army had ever risked penetrating it in the preceding 20 years. Sort of like Afghanistan. My battalion, the 450-man 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry of the U.S. Army, had come looking for trouble in the Yadrang. We had found all we wanted and more. Two regiments of regulars of the People's Army of Vietnam, more than 2,000 men, were resting and regrouping in their sanctuary near here and preparing to resume combat operations when we dropped in on them. We dropped in on them the day before. General Mon's commanders reacted with speed and fury, and now we were all fighting for our lives. Now, what transpired from Sunday through Tuesday was a bloody battle between a small force of 450 Army Airborne Rangers and 2,000 North Vietnamese regulars. It doesn't matter the number. What matters is the training and the expertise and the will of those who are in combat. Our men are going to be complimented through the course of this study. Individuals are going to be cited. But what it boils down to is, at least at that time, we had the best trained army in the world that had the opportunity to fight an opponent that was four times its size and defeated them. That's not aspersions on our military today. It's just that our military today is even more restricted in rules of engagement than even during the Vietnam conflict. The fighting was intense and unrelenting throughout, but under the deft leadership of Colonel Moore and Sergeant Major Basil L. Plumley, The 1st Battalion and reinforcements from the 2nd Battalion were able to establish and hold their command post at Landing Zone X-Ray. The leadership in the trenches became the source of legend. Captain Myron F. Diederich and 2nd Lieutenant Rick Rescola of Bravo Company 2nd Battalion were instrumental in the defense of repeated Vietnam attacks on X-Ray the second day and night of the battle. I want to go down to these fellows that have been mentioned here. You have Lieutenant Colonel Hal Moore at his command post during X-Ray. This is probably a photograph shot by Joe Galloway. This is on November the 15th. A recent photograph of General Moore to the right. My friend Jim Lawrence is friends with Hal Moore, and he told me recently that Hal is suffering from dementia at this time in his life. This is Basil L. Plumley. This is a photograph circa 1965. On the right, you see a recent photograph of him. I can't remember. I think it was Virgil Earp that played Plumley in the movie. Myron F. Diederich. He'll be complimented in a moment by General Moore. And then, of course, there is Rick Rescola in action at X-Ray. This is the cover photo on the book We Were Soldiers, written by Moore and Galloway. And a photograph of him circa 2000. We'll find out why he's no longer with us. And I think that does all of the photographs for us. Let me back up to the map. But I wanted you to see who we're talking about here as we move forward. Colonel Moore wrote of Diederich, "He was eager and aggressive, yet totally professional. Over the course of 3 days and nights, he would emerge as the finest battlefield company commander I had ever seen, bar none." Rick Rescola esteemed himself not only at X-Ray, but also at Albany. He left active duty in 1967, but continued in the Army Reserves until his retirement in 1990 as a colonel. Rescola, British-born, earned a master's degree and a law degree at universities in Oklahoma. He went into corporate security work and became vice president for group security for the Morgan Stanley Financial Group. In a way, Rick was on the front lines of the Islamic War, as reported by Rick Scavetta of the Stars and Stripes magazine. Scavetta writes, born in Haley, England, in 1939, Rescola joined the U.S. Army in the 1960s and went to Vietnam as a platoon leader with the B Company, 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry. In November 1965, his unit plunged into a battle at Landing Zone X-Ray at the base of the Chu Phong, a 2,400-foot mountain in the Yadrang Valley. He later survived a North Vietnamese ambush at nearby Landing Zone Albany. They claimed the lives of 151 men in his unit. During combat in Vietnam, Lieutenant Rick Rescola would sing to his troops to keep their spirits high while under fire. As head of security for Morgan Stanley Dean Winter in New York, Rescola used the same tactics to calm co-workers as he led them from their offices during the attacks on the World Trade Center. Rescola survived battlefields in Southwest Asia, but he apparently was not so fortunate September the 11th. Currently on the missing list, and this article was written in 2001, currently on the missing list, Rescola was last seen in a 10th floor staircase. He is credited with saving 3,000 colleagues while sacrificing himself. These two men of Bravo Company and the 2nd Battalion were instrumental in enabling the 1st Battalion to endure fighting that was extremely fierce during the night of 15 November and the early morning of 16 November. The exploits of these men are glorified in Randall Wallace's We Were Soldiers. The movie shows an offensive action at the end of the movie that did not occur. However, those who survived the battle and who have seen the movie claim that but for this Hollywood ending, the rest of the film depicts every scene accurately at the Battle of X-Ray. Jim Lawrence told me in a telephone interview that he was asked by a reporter following the film's premiere at Fort Benning if the movie was an accurate representation of the battle. He said that he reported by saying, "Yes, in every way but one, there wasn't the smell." The smell was a combination of literal blood, sweat, napalm, gun smoke, explosives, bombs, and the ever-intensifying stench of decaying bodies of the dead. Having repulsed repeated frontal assaults by the Vietnamese soldiers, the killing ground was littered with nearly 1,000 enemy dead. It was decided to evacuate all personnel who had been engaged in the conflict up to this point and replace them with elements of the 2nd Battalion of the 7th Cavalry and the 1st Battalion of the 5th Cavalry. These replacements closed in on X-ray at about noon on the 16th. In the forefront of the column was Private First Class Jack P. Smith, son of radio and television broadcast journalist Howard K. Smith. Jack Smith wrote of what he saw in a 1967 article for the Saturday Evening Post. He writes that the 1st Battalion had been fighting continuously for 3 or 4 days, and I had never seen such filthy troops. They all had that look of shock. They said little, just looked around with darting, nervous eyes. Whenever I heard a shell coming close, I'd duck, but they kept standing. There must have been 1,000 rotting bodies out there, starting at about 20 feet, surrounding the giant circle of foxholes. You got 450 men over 3 days fighting off 2,000, and by the third day they'd killed half of them. An unlikely combatant in the battle at X-ray was Joe Galloway. In the thick of the conflict, he was issued a weapon, and he gallantly fought along with the Rangers in defense of the command post. On leaving X-ray the afternoon of the 16th, Galloway commented to fellow journalist Charlie Black of the Columbus, Georgia Ledger-Inquirer, "These are the greatest soldiers that have ever gone into a fight. There hasn't been any outfit like this before. It's something I wish every American could understand what these kids did." I think I might even, if I drill down, find a picture of some. Well, those are my Medal of Honor winners. Apparently, I think I did a picture of Galloway, but apparently I didn't put it in the slideshow here. Galloway was a newspaper photographer for UPI, and he was simply with this group when they went in with the 7th Cavalry. He was with them simply to do photographic journalism, and he was caught up in this contest, and it was so intense that he was issued a weapon, and he therefore joined in the fray. Colonel Moore had promised his men that none would be left behind, meaning there would be no MIAs in the 1st Battalion. And he kept his word. Of those under his command, 79 were killed in action and 121 were wounded. Now, killed in action is 79. Killed in action for the Vietnamese combatants was around 1,000. This was over 3 days. None were missing. He estimated that 634 of the enemy were killed in combat and another 1,215 by artillery and air attacks. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon of 16 November, Colonel Moore was the last man to lift off of Landing Zone X-ray, leaving the area under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Bob Tully and his 2nd Battalion 5th Cavalry, and Lieutenant Colonel Robert McDade's 2nd Battalion 7th Cavalry. It was in the latter of which Jim Lawrence was assigned to Delta Company. On the morning of the 17th of November, these two battalions were exiting X-ray in a march toward Landing Zone Columbus. Now, I want to go back to the maps that I have just gone by. There are several maps on here. This one shows the wide shot of Yadrang Valley. We've already noted that. But you can also see that landing zone X-ray is here, Albany is here, and Columbus is here. Those three landing zones will enter into the next section of our study. Now you can see what the objective was as they leave X-ray here. They're going to march to Columbus. That was the objective. This is a landing zone, and they were to be brought out of the contest at that point. However, something happened at this point, and more is not even clear on why. But the 7th Cavalry made a left turn, and they were directed to go over to Albany. And the 5th went up to Columbus, and they were exited out there. It's what's happened between Columbus and Albany that takes up the next part of our study. This turned out to be probably one of the most deadly battles as far as percentages are concerned in U.S. history. On the morning of 17 November, these two battalions were to exit X-ray and march together toward landing zone Columbus. Short of Columbus, the 2nd Battalion was to peel off and head toward the northwest with landing zone Albany as its destination. The reason for these movements is not exactly clear, according to General Moore in his book. It is assumed that there were three objectives with circumstances determining which would be executed. Number one, engage the enemy. They honestly didn't think there would be an enemy. They thought that they had pretty much done them out. Secondly, the second potential objective, evacuate the area for the B-52 assault on Chupong Mountain. And the third option, be picked up and transported back to An Ki Air Base. The latter exercise was the one anticipated. No enemy was in sight from the battle of the previous 3 days. They did not expect to encounter the enemy on the march. Well, they were wrong, and they were dead wrong. As they advanced toward Albany, they were coming closer and closer to an encounter with enemy soldiers. Just beyond Albany was a base camp established that included three battalions of the North Vietnamese Army. The 8th, 1st, and 3rd Battalions were headquartered there. And you see in this diagram here how things are arranged. This is what they walked into. You have the Alpha Company of the 7th Cavalry, and then Delta, and then Charlie, the Headquarters Company, and then you have the Alpha Company of the 5th. And then, therefore, they're marching in a row. They're single file, basically, as they move into this landing zone. And we'll describe what happens next. But you can see where the Viet Cong were located, these three divisions. And we'll see exactly how they learned of the arrival of this group of men and what transpired after that. The latter exercise of being picked up and shipped out, of course, was what they assumed would happen. As they advanced toward Albany, they were coming closer and closer to an encounter with enemy soldiers. The 8th, 1st, and 3rd Battalions were headquartered there. The 8th was a reserve battalion, newly arrived off the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They were fresh, rested, and spoiling for a fight with the Americans. As the American soldiers approached Albany, they unfortunately burned some hooches, small grass huts, and this caught the attention of a Vietnamese recon team. Some were captured by Alpha Company of the 7th, which led the column, and they were interrogated. At this point, the column lost unit integrity. They had been marching in file with Alpha Company in the lead, followed in order by Delta, Charlie, Headquarters, and finally Alpha Company of the 1st Battalion, 5th Cavalry. With the capture of the scouts, a sequence of events occurred that led to one of the most deadly battles in the entire Vietnam War. Alpha Company was ordered to stand fast by Colonel McDade, who radioed that he was going to come forward to interrogate the prisoners. So Alpha Company is up here, and McDade is back with headquarters. He calls a halt to the entire line, and he is going to go forward and link up with Alpha Company of the 7th. That was a mistake. On arrival, McDade called for all company commanders to join him at the head of the column. What happened next set the stage for the surprise attack that was about to commence. Specialist 4, Bob Tolles of Delta Company, tells what happened farther back down the column. Everyone dropped to the ground. I sat leaning against a tree facing the rear of the column. When the command group closed up, that means moving forward, a gap of 30 to 40 yards opened in the line of the march. And that means that this group here has moved forward, and therefore, as a result, you have a big gap that has occurred in this line. And this is what he's referring to. He writes that we lounged around smoking, just taking it easy. Then the mortar platoon sergeant came up. He went directly to First Lieutenant James Lawrence, Delta's new executive officer, to learn the situation. The sergeant left his gear behind him when he walked over. He wore his web belt and packed a pistol, but carried no rifle and didn't wear his steel pot. Lawrence put out the information that the head of the column took two prisoners and then instructed that others could be in the area. At this precise moment, on the brink of disaster, this is what was happening. Alpha Company was moving forward toward the Albany clearing. Colonel McDade and his battalion command group were with Alpha Company. The other company commanders had left their companies under orders and were moving up to join McDade for a conference. So the commanders of all of these units are now up with A as they are approaching the landing zone itself. So there's no leadership anywhere down the line. The other company commanders had left their companies under orders and were moving up to join McDade for a conference. The battalion was strung out along a line of march for a distance of about 150 yards. The men of Delta Company were lolling around on the ground. Charlie Company had flankers off to each side, but most were taking a break, sitting or lying down. Greg Forrest's men at the tail of the column were in a wedge formation, and also had flank security posted. The men of the battalion were worn out after nearly 60 hours without sleep and 4 hours of marching through difficult terrain. Visibility in the chest-high elephant grass was extremely limited. Just after 1 o'clock p.m., McDade and his company commanders reached the Albany clearing. All the brass was at the head of the line, and the entire contingent had North Vietnamese surrounding them. At about 1:07, small arms fire began. The Americans had marched right into the base camp of the newly arrived 8th Battalion and the 66th Regiment, along with the 1st and 3rd Battalions of the 33rd Regiment. They had gotten the news the column was on the way to Albany from their recon team and had hurriedly organized an ambush. The most savage one-day battle of the Vietnam War had just begun. The 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry, had walked into a hornet's nest. The North Vietnamese Reserve Force, the 550-man 8th Battalion, 66th Regiment, had been bivouacked in the woods off the northeast of McDade's column. The understrength 1st Battalion and 8th Battalion were aiming their men toward the head of the American column. While many of Colonel McDade's troopers lay in the grass resting, North Vietnamese soldiers swarmed toward them by the hundreds. A deadly ordeal by fire was beginning in the tall elephant grass around Albany and along the column of American troops strung out through the jungle waiting for orders to move. It was 1:15 p.m., Wednesday, November 17. By the time the battle ended in the pre-dawn darkness the next morning, 155 American soldiers would be dead and another 124 wounded. Those who survived would never forget the savagery, the brutality, and butchery of those 16 hours. The strategy used by the attacking Vietnamese Army was employed by their battlefield commander, Senior Lieutenant Colonel Nguyen Huan. He wrote, "I gave orders to my battalion. When you meet the Americans, divide yourself into many groups and attack the column from all directions and divide the column into many pieces. Viewed from the American side, the firefight began at the head of the 2nd Battalion Column and swiftly spread down the east side of the American line in full-fledged roar. In fact, the commanders were absent from their companies when the fight started, contributed to the confusion. It had the most effect on Charlie Company. Their commander, Skip Fessmeyer, was up at Albany, and Don Cornett, the Charlie Company executive officer, was killed early on. They had no commander, and they just disintegrated. Colonel McDade wasn't getting anything from his people down the line. Charlie, Delta, and Headquarters Company weren't reporting because they were either dead or, in the case of Headquarters, didn't have any radios. Well, the battle was afoot and was waged in a relentless hail of bullets and hand-to-hand combat. Suddenly, the 1st Cavalry Airborne found itself in a time warp that was reminiscent of the trench warfare of World War I and Korea. This is a report from Bob Toll. As the front came alive with intense firing and no information came back to him, Bob Toll's concern doubled. Toll is Spec 4 with Delta Company. He writes that North Vietnamese troops shattered the foliage and headed straight for us, AK-47 rifles blazing and on the dead run. I selected the closest one and fired twice. I hit him, but he refused to go down. He kept coming and he kept shooting. I turned my M16 on full automatic, fired, and he crumpled. I shifted to another target and squeezed the trigger. They kept pouring out of the wood line. We kept firing. Then finally, they stopped coming. The lull didn't last long. Tolls peered beyond the anthill toward the mortar platoon. It appeared as if the ground was opening up and swallowing the mortarmen. They fell so fast, said PFC James Shadden. A brown wave of death rolled over them and on into the Charlie Company. Vietnamese intermixed with them. Then reality set in. The enemy held the ground beyond the anthill. The column was cut in half. Incoming gunfire drew our attention back to the tree line. The volume of fire became almost unendurable. Bullets peeled bark from trees. Vegetation disintegrated. I looked to Lieutenant James Lawrence for help. I saw his head violently recoil, and he hit the ground. A second later, I was spun around and slammed into the dirt. I rose to my hands and knees and started down the line. Blood ran everywhere. Someone raised Lieutenant Lawrence and attempted to steady him. The firing continued. Each and every man still alive on that field, American and North Vietnamese, were fighting for his life. And the tall grass, it was nearly impossible for the soldiers of either side to identify friend or foe, except at extremely close range. Americans in olive drab and North Vietnamese in mustard brown were fighting and dying side by side. It may have begun as a hasty ambush or a surprise attack, but within minutes, the result was a wild melee, a shootout, with the gunfighters killing not only the enemy, but sometimes their friends just a few feet away. There would be no cheap victory here this day for any side. There would be no victory at all, just the terrible certainty of death in the long grass. Jim Lawrence was one of the 124 who were wounded at Albany. He recovered in an army hospital in the Philippines. He was awarded the Bronze Star, the Purple Heart, as well as the Air Medal and the Army Commendation Medal. Today, he is Education Director of the Alabama Center for Real Estate in the University of Alabama's Culver House College of Commerce. Almost every year on Veterans Day weekend, he and the survivors of the Yadrang campaign gather in Washington, D.C. for a reunion. They conduct a vigil at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial and observe in quiet remembrance the names inscribed on panel 3 East. For 37 years, the memory of the two battles at X-Ray and Albany causes each of these men to revisit those chaotic days in the sweltering jungles of Vietnam. They remembered those whom they call friends, who fell in fray, and many wonder, as surviving combatants often do, about why their friend was taken and they were left. This is how General Moore describes the annual greeting and its gathering in Washington, D.C. It is easy to forget the numbers, but how can we forget the faces? The voices, the cries of young men dying before their time. Between October 23rd and November 26th, 1965, a total of 305 young American soldiers were killed in combat in the Pleiku campaign. Their names marched down the lines inscribed on Panel 3 East of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, each one a national treasure, each one a national tragedy. What would they have become, all of them, if they had been allowed to serve their country by their lives instead of by their deaths? Yes, there is an organization, the Yadrang Alumni, our own band of brothers, and we have a dinner before Veterans Day in Washington every November, and a lunch wherever the 1st Cavalry Division Association holds its reunion every summer. For we find pleasure and healing in the company of friends and comrades of our youth. We begin by calling the roll, first reading the names of all those who fell and those who have joined them since. Then one by one we stand to call out our own names, ranks, military occupations, companies and battalions, and where we fought in the valley. There are no dues. Those were paid in blood long ago, and there are no officers. In the small, closed world of military, great victories, great defeats, and great sacrifices are never forgotten. They are remembered with battle streamers attached to unit flags. Among the scores of streamers that billow and whirl around the flags of all the battalions of the 1st Cavalry Division, there is one deep blue presidential unit citation streamer that says simply, Pleiku Province. We remember those days and our comrades, and long after we're gone, that long blue streamer will still caress proud flags. With the news of Colonel Moore and Mr. Galloway's book, We Were Soldiers, is the title, We Were Soldiers Once and Young, and that the news that was going to be made into a movie, Jim was inspired to put to paper many of the thoughts that he carried with him over the years. And as we come back for the second session, I will lead off with his unpublished manuscript, Reflections on Albany, and his loose verse poem, Fields of Fire. So we'll pause now for a break for tea and crumpets, and we'll come back with a poem and then some other excerpts that I would like to read you, especially the Medal of Honor citations of those who were awarded that particular medal in this combat. So we'll dismiss now for refreshments to my right, and we'll reassemble in about 20 to 25 minutes.